Sweet Spot listeners, we have an incredible deal on a new product from one of our favorite companies, ShotScope. You know that if you listen to this show, Adam and I are big on strategy and tracking stats like strokes gained. ShotScope has just released their new V5 GPS watch. There are tons of upgrades like full color maps of each hole, GPS distances to hazards, layup points, and doglegs, and more importantly, dynamic yardages to the front, middle, and back of every green. You're also going to get 16 of their second generation shot tracking tags that will automatically track all of your shots. That way, you're going to get access to over 100 statistics on their online portal, and you'll be able to see your strokes gained and handicap benchmarking against other golfers. So if you want to make a plan to improve, you can clearly see which part of your game needs the most help, and more importantly, the whys. The best part about ShotScope is that there are no ongoing fees for using their stat tracking portal. So now for our deal. We are giving Sweet Spot listeners in the US and Canada a $70 discount. Yes, you heard that correctly. That brings the price of the watch down to $179.99. All you have to do is go to ShotScope.com, add the V5 GPS watch to your cart, and use promo code SWEETSPOT, that's one word, at checkout. Once again, go to ShotScope.com, add the V5 GPS watch to your cart, and use promo code SWEETSPOT for your $70 discount.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to another episode of The Sweet Spot. This is John Sherman from Practical Golf, and as always, I'm joined by
Adam from Adam Young Golf.
This episode of The Sweet Spot is brought to you by our friends at the Indoor Golf Shop. They are the place to go online for setting up a golf simulator in your home or business. They've got all the major brands of launch monitors like Foresight, Skytrack, Unicore, and FlightScope. And they make great enclosures, screens, hitting mats, pretty much anything you need for your indoor studio. And if you need some help, you can call them directly and speak to their experts. Ask for Gerald or Hunter if you have questions about what system's appropriate for your budget or the size of your garage, media room, or basement. So you can check out the Indoor Golf Shop. They are located at shopindoorgolf.com. And thanks again for their support. So we're recording this episode in December of 2021, but I'm almost certain it's going to premiere in 2022. So I guess we can preemptively wish everyone a happy new year.
Yep. Happy new year, everyone.
Pretty much been a year since we started the show. Isn't that crazy?
Really?
Yes. We started last January.
All right. That's flown by.
I know. This will be our 44th episode. So we've been fairly consistent. And needless to say, I think we're really blown away and super happy with how many people listen to us on a weekly basis, how many people reach out with questions, feedbacks, criticism, all that stuff. It's been, I think, awesome for both of us. And yeah, we really appreciate all the support we get from all the listeners.
What are your New Year's goals?
I'm not really a resolution type person. As I've grown older, not that I'm that old, but I guess I'm getting a little wiser. I'm more into the habits thing. So I'm just trying to, you know, whether it's golf or professional life, personal life, I'm just trying to maintain positive habits. So I've referred to my little sheet that is in front of me on my desk right now. Again, I want to finish my book in 2022, so I'll be working on that until it's finished, hopefully maybe by early spring. I want to keep up my physical routines, that type of stuff, you know, lifting weights, doing speed training.
Table tennis.
Table tennis
in the metaverse.
Oh my God, how nerdy do we want to get? Now, Adam, this is probably way too much info, but maybe people will get a kick out of this. You got the Oculus Quest 2, and then you convinced me to buy it. And now I'm obsessed playing ping pong on this thing in the metaverse.
And I've injured my right hip now. So I'm getting loads of emails. How's your left hip doing? So thank you for everybody for being concerned. My left hip is almost fully healed now. And it's basically transferred to my right hip because the other day I spent about 5 hours in the metaverse playing table tennis. Yeah, my body wasn't ready for it. So constantly standing on my right leg or stamping into my right foot as I hit the table tennis ball, the ping pong ball. Yeah, I've got an overuse injury, so I'm going to have to take some time off table tennis now and do some golf instead.
Yeah, you got to keep your eye on the prize. But I have to say, that game, I mean, we'll give them a free plug. I mean, I wasn't expecting much from this thing, but it is like playing. I mean, I was a ping pong fanatic in my teenage years and early 20s. I used to play a lot. And it's like playing the real thing again. Like, I love it. And you can play against people online. It's ridiculous. But 99% of people listening to this are like, all right, enough about that. Talk about the golf.
Well, I don't think people can realize like how realistic it is, how realistic the physics is. They think it's probably like a computer game. But when you're actually inside, you feel like the amount of times I've put the paddles on the table and dropped them and then realized the table doesn't actually exist. It's just, it's a virtual reality thing. I just wonder how or where it's going to go with golf even. I know they've got a few little games out. I haven't tried them yet, but I could see them building a pretty realistic golf simulator in the future with realistic golf physics.
Yeah, I would be interested in that. I'm actually looking at my friend sent a text earlier of this guy. I guess it's his first time on a VR set. It looks like the PlayStation one, and he's like kind of looking around on that skyscraper one, and then he promptly jumps through the TV screen that it's broadcasting to, because it feels that real. So any nerds out there who like to play video games, I wasn't a video game person recently. I used to be, but that kind of got me back into it. So it's been a lot of fun. In any event, what are we talking about today?
We are talking about quick fixes, band-aids, and compensations. So these are terms that get thrown around a lot. And I just wanted to discuss my ideas of them, because I think they're all kind of banded together. There are obvious similarities between what the concepts are, but there are differences as well. I just think it'd be a good conversation to get the mental juices flowing on this and get people thinking a little bit more critically, challenge some beliefs perhaps, and get them thinking outside the box.
I'm looking at your notes. I've got your email here. This is probably like the reverse of our scratch golf episode, where I sent you a ton of notes and you were like, well, I don't know what I have to contribute to this conversation. And then we talked for 3 hours. So I'm sure I'm going to have some thoughts here, but you're going to kind of lead the charge for us, because I do think it's, you know, when I think of like quick fixes and band-aids, often we argue about words in golf because they can mean different things to different people. I often think about quick fixes and band-aids in a negative way, just because I think it was really one of the reasons why I started Practical Golf, is because I felt that golfers were so trained to getting these superficial swing tips that really weren't addressing their flaws. They were too generic in nature. And that obviously creates that hamster wheel that we constantly talk about, where the player is changing one thing. You know, it's one tip 1 week and then another tip the next week. So I think this could be an interesting conversation, because there absolutely are examples of quick little changes you can make. And I've made them myself that do have longstanding benefits in the game. Of course, the challenge is discerning between the two.
So you think that a quick, or when you hear that term quick fix, you have a negative association with it, right? Which I think is where most people are at.
Yeah, absolutely. Like if I'm being totally honest, like that's where my head goes. But what we're going to do and, you know, explore this concept, as I was preparing for this in my head, I was just thinking about all the little things that I've kind of experimented with and done through practice and being on the course all these years. And I can think of, yeah, plenty of quick fixes that I made that actually are with me today that turned out great. So I think like anything else, there's two sides to the coin, and hopefully we'll explore that for everyone. Where do you want to start with this?
Yeah, we can start with the quick fix idea. I mean, that's the main point I wanted to get out of the quick fix thing, is that quick fix, or something that works, changes you, improves you instantly, is not always a bad thing. It can be long-lasting as well. I think there's two different camps. There are people who may go for a lesson and they expect to be fixed quickly. That's the expectation. I think there's the other end of that side, where people who have had lots of lessons in the past, they see that, no, actually, you probably got to put a lot of work in. Even if it's a good swing change, you have to put a lot of work in before, you know, things become ingrained. But It's just the idea that something that works quickly is not always a bad thing. Because I do see people brand, oh, that's just a quick fix. That's just a quick fix, as if it's going to fall apart at some point.
I think one of the reasons why it does have a negative connotation is because of the marketing side of the golf industry. So I'm subscribed to all these random lists where I get emails promoting all types of training aids and other junk that people sell. And all of them share a very similar theme. Fix your slice, add 20 yards. And like, you know, a lot of them are training aids. And let's face it, some of them are poorly designed. But the promise is that quick fix. Or if someone's selling, like even when people are going on YouTube, the ads they see, the sell is a quick fix. So I think that's what is being fought against, is because the industry sells quick fixes. But I don't think the industry necessarily cares as a whole whether it fixes the golfer or not, because they want people coming back for more. You know, if I'm taking the negative side of it, like, yeah, I think that's where a lot of it comes from, is like the marketing / commercial side of the golf industry.
Yeah, I think we'll see as we go through this that how this phrase relates to the Band-Aid phrase as well. But in terms of quick fix, I mean, we have to be realistic. Nothing is ever fixed in golf, right?
No,
and I think that that's a big myth that I had when I was a kid, and I'm sure lots of golfers, I know lots of golfers have, is that they think, oh, if I can just fix this, and usually it's X swing piece, then I'll be okay. Then I can start to play golf, because all my shots will fly straight forever then, once this piece is fixed. And that just doesn't exist. No one has ever fixed their swing so that every ball flies straight. The average pro hits, what, 60% of fairways, 60% of greens. So nothing is ever fixed. They make mistakes, and they make big mistakes. I think the idea there is to manage your patterns and get better at managing your patterns, which is what we talk about with the awareness stuff, the skill-based stuff, that helps you look at the patterns that you've got and quickly recalibrate them if you have to. It's less about fixing your swing and more teaching you how to become a mechanic, or your own best mechanic. And that sounds mechanical in terms of swing mechanics. I might not be talking about swing mechanics. It might be the thing that we talk about, right? Which is just change the club face position, or, you know, hit a different part of the face. But you've got to be able to identify those things and have the tools to recalibrate them, whether they're simple tools, like just intention-based tools, or they could be more complex tools, like, you know, understanding how the swing mechanics work and how that influences these patterns. But yeah, nothing is ever fixed in golf. Where if you do fix it, if you do have a good game, it will break at some point in the future. So it's just that highlighting that expectation for people.
We've kind of gone negative with it, or I have gone negative with it initially. What do you think is a positive, quote unquote, like, I mean, maybe fix isn't the right word, but that's the one we're choosing, a solution, improvement. What would be an example in your mind of something that would have a positive outcome on a golfer's performance that was quote unquote quick?
Okay, so at the risk of obviously repeating everything we've ever said in every other podcast, one of the ones that comes up a lot for me, and I've had this even in lessons where I've improved someone and they say, oh, but that's just a quick fix, is, you know, if someone has a poor strike pattern, say they are coming to the lesson tee and they're shanking everything, and we train them how to use their intention to hit more towards the toe. So we might do a little exercise starting with chipping. Hit the toe 10 times, and then we build it up over time. And during that, they never shank it. Or, you know, it depends on the player, how good their concentration is and how good my teaching process is on that day. But they will greatly reduce the number of shanks during that session. And some people are like, oh, yeah, that's awesome. Love that. I will go off and practice that. But some people may say, oh, but that's just a quick fix. Again, with the connotation, oh, this isn't going to last. Well, that's where my challenge comes in, is that the people who I know, the people who take this philosophy on board, the skill development, intention-based training, and they truly practice it, it's actually one of the longest lasting and most robust things that you can do for your golf game. So it is something that works quickly. It is something that maybe is not traditionally seen as golf instruction, But the idea that, oh, this is going to just fall apart in the future is complete false. And I would say it's the complete opposite. In fact, I would go as far to say a mechanical change to fix a shank is probably more of a quick fix that will fall apart later. Because mechanically, there are 100 ways that you can shank a ball. And so if you just fix, in air quotes, one of them, at some point in the future, the player will probably find a new way to shank it. Or they may even find the opposite, right? They'll start towing it. So mechanical fixes don't last as long as a player who has mastered the skill and ability. And you know this first, John, right?
Yeah, I mean, some that come to mind, and I'll ask for your opinion on it. Let's say like grip, for example. So when someone looks up how to fix a slice, often the advice is, well, you got to strengthen your grip because that'll help close the club face more, because most people who are slicing it are swiping across the ball with an open club face. And you know, there's two fixes for that. Neutralize the swing path, or get that club face pointing a little bit more left at impact so that the ball has an opportunity to start left of the target and then curve back to it. When I was reading your notes, that's the one that came to mind, is because I think for a lot of players, like, yes, that absolutely could help them not fix their slice, but at least reduce it. And for other players, it might not do a damn thing. I think grip technique is super important because it could influence a lot of things in your golf swing. Maybe we'll do a separate episode on that. I know that's our catchphrase on the Sweet Spot. But I know for me, like, going to a super strong grip with my left hand just made me a much better ball striker. So that's kind of one that pops out in my head that can go either way, is like, yeah, you could change your grip. And if you had the wrong grip matchup and you went to the right one, it could feel like, wow, this is, now I've got something here. And vice versa, if it's not the appropriate change, it could make you worse. So that one kind of comes to mind when I think about this concept.
Well, that's an interesting one, just speaking from a teaching perspective, as to how, I suppose that goes down the route of how people respond to a change. It's not always as predicted. You would say that, well, if I took 100 slices with weak grips and I give them all a stronger grip, that would reduce their slice. And I would say on a 100 golfer perspective, that would probably work in about 95% of golfers. It would improve them. But there may be a subset of golfers who it works a complete opposite way. They take a stronger grip and for whatever reason, they add other things in the swing that actually opens the face even more. I'm an example of that. I could be suffering with a left shot and take a weaker grip, which logically should reduce my left shot. But I know I sometimes feel in the backswing with a weaker grip, oh my God, this face is open. And then I rotate my hands at the bottom to try and square it up out of fear of missing it right. So there's almost and that's an unconscious thing. I can sense it after the fact that I've done that. You know, that I've rotated and flipped my hands at the bottom. I can sense that after the fact. It is an unconscious thing. And so a weak grip for me doesn't always have the effect that it should have, in theory at least. So, yeah, I mean, that's a different, I mean, we could probably make another podcast on that one. But yeah, how people respond to certain things. And I suppose when we talk about matchups, I think we've gone away from model swing, right? Most people, most instructors, most people listening to this are probably under the right assumption that there is no model swing. And they're under a better assumption that, oh no, it just has to, there has to be good matchups in your swing. But you can go down a bad road with that and think there are perfect matchups as well. Like, oh, I just need to know exactly which matchups I need to have. And that's not true either. I would say, and I'm starting to use this more, they're just options. It's options, not necessarily perfect matchups or swing model. Does that make sense? Or am I kind of rambling down a wrong road here?
Yeah, no, I think it makes sense to me. Here's another one I'll throw at you. What about like just ball position, something like that? That to me is something that, like, you know, if you saw a golfer who had the ball teed up low in the middle of their stance with the driver and they're hitting these low duck hooks, then potentially a better matchup for them would be moving up, you know, moving the ball up in their stance and teeing it higher. That would, you know, probably neutralize the in-to-out path. They would hit up on it, and that could be a solution. Again, very quick fix, but it could fix someone or it could not. So maybe I'm getting off the beaten path on this, but, you know, I'm thinking back to like my own game and the kind of small adjustments I make during my practice sessions when I'm looking at my ball flight. And those are things that have helped me, like getting the right ball position with my irons and driver to suit my swing. I have to get them in the right spot or else I'm going to get myself a little bit behind and not giving myself as best chance as possible for my matchups to work. So people often talk about like posture, grip, setup, like sometimes that stuff gets a bad rap, but like, yeah, that could be something that, you know, a golfer just has like the wrong setup for certain clubs in their bag, whether it's their grip, ball position, tee height, stuff like that can make a significant change in someone's game for the long term.
Yeah, I suppose this is kind of where quick fixes might morph into band-aids, or we can start to go down that road. So I just wanted to make the point or get people to take away from this that a quick fix is not always a bad thing. Something that works instantly might hold up for the rest of your life, especially if it's something like skill development. But a band-aid, to define a band-aid, I think this is what most people mean when they say quick fix. Yeah. It's something that kind of eases the pain, but it's not necessarily a long-term solution. So like a band-aid on a broken leg, it might fix the cut or help the cut that's on top of it, but it's not going to fix the broken leg that's deeper down. And I would say a band-aid is also characterized by having intentionality behind it. So what I mean by that is someone is intentionally adding something. So, you know, when someone comes to me for a lesson, they say, well, I've been having this problem, and then I tried this, and it worked. When they say, I tried this, I look at that this, and I say, well, is that a band-aid? Is that something that relates? Is it something that is actually going to help them long-term? Or have they just done something that's hurt themselves elsewhere? Because, you know, if you put a band-aid on a broken leg and then you go out and you start walking, you're probably going to cause more damage. And so there are things in golf that I would categorize as band-aids that could hurt you long-term, could be in the operative word, that might help you short-term. When I'm in a lesson and I hear band-aid, I say to people, well, you've just taken a watch that stopped and you've whacked it on the table and it started again, right? And you go, look, it's worked, right? That's where a band-aid is to me. It's like, well, yeah, you got the watch ticking again, but you just smacked the watch on the table. You're probably doing some damage. And the more you do that, the worse it's going to get for that watch.
If we're going two routes with a short, let's call it a short-term change, and then what we discussed earlier, which I'm totally on board with, obviously, is like, I think you have a much better chance of making long-term improvements to your game with the skill-based intention we constantly talk about on this show, or even what I just mentioned, like having the appropriate grip or setup with your driver or stuff like that. Like those are short-term changes that it can happen in a matter of minutes, and it could be a solution long-term. I think the word quick fix is more associated with what we're saying. We're making a mess of words here, but that's what I think of like the band-aid. It's more like that, where it's like, oh, you're just trying to slap something, like something is very wrong in your golf game. And let's face it, a lot of the times it's the slice. And people are trying to slap these band-aids, these short-term changes to fix it. And they're not long-term solutions. Like it might help one week and then the next week they're back to square one. And that to me is like easily the most frustrating thing about golf and the biggest challenge for the average player, is because it's so hard to know the difference between the two, because you could get like good results for a couple of rounds and then it's like, oh, it doesn't work anymore. Now what? It's a tough one.
That's why skill development and awareness of, you know, things like the impact laws is so important, because when you have that, you never get stuck. Like I'm never practicing and I start hitting a bad shot and I panic and I'm like, oh my God, what do I have to do? I'm like, no, I have a bunch of options. Okay, the ball is going left today. I have a bunch of options. I could do this with my grip. I could open the face at address. I could feel this in the swing. I could try to present the face open. I have all these different options and I can select from those the ones that I know historically have worked best for me. Whereas, yeah, you're right. When you fix, and I've seen this in teaching, from my own teaching and from others' teaching, when you fix an outcome issue mechanically, you might get it there on the spot. You might get it correct. But at some point, if the pupil doesn't understand and they don't have the skill and awareness to do this stuff themselves, at some point that's just going to break down again, and they're either going to overdo the fix and have the complete opposite fault, or they'll find a new way to do the old fault. That's why I think it's important to understand that mechanical fixes, sometimes they can be the band-aid fix, or not band-aid, but they can be the quick fix that doesn't last. You know, that old connotation that, oh, quick fix is just going to fall apart. Well, mechanical fixes can be like that.
I was thinking back as we were discussing this, pretty sure I was 19 years old and I had played that very brief year of college golf and I barely played. And I remember we went on a spring break trip, Robert Trent Jones Golf Trail in Alabama. We were playing a ton of golf and like I hadn't played in months. My game was a disaster. And I remember being on the range the first day and I was just like hitting the ball. Like it was bad. It was embarrassing. And I'm looking over to one of my teammates who had this like punch swing. His name is Brian. He had this like very bizarre swing where he would just like kind of hit this low punch, similar to like maybe Paul Azinger, it comes to mind. And I'm like, I'm going to copy him. So I put the ball in the back of my stance and I just start trapping the ball. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm striping it. And I continue to do this for a few rounds, even with my driver. I was like trapping the ball in every shot. And I've actually played a few great rounds. And then as the week went on, like other problems arise. And I'm like, oh, I don't know how to fix that. So you talking about the band-aid, like that was a perfect example of something I did. It involved ball position and a mechanical change. I moved the ball back in my stance. I was trying to trap it and hit this punch shot. Worked for a couple of rounds and then I was back to square one, totally clueless again.
Yeah. So, you know, you've done something, you've added something consciously there that's kind of alleviated the issue, but long-term has caused worse issues. So that's like a perfect example of a band-aid. So some other things that, you know, just to give other people examples so they can get a clear idea, someone who's skying the ball, just teeing it lower might be a band-aid there. It's not always a bad thing. And again, I'm not going to say all these band-aids will have real negative issues, but when someone's skying it, it's an arc height control issue. You know, they're swinging the club too low relative to where the ball is in space. That's the simplest way I can give them. The ball is at X point in space and you're swinging it below it, so you end up hitting it high on the face and skying it. Yes, teeing it down is going to alleviate that issue, but it might not be the best way. How is that going to hurt you in the future? Well, it might not be the best way to achieve optimal trajectory. You could instead learn the skill of swinging the club at a different height. You know, I would ask people, can you just pick the top of the tee? Can you hit the base of the tee? And learn through intentionality how to control the height of the club in space. That, for me, is a longer term fix than just dropping the tee height. Because that gives people options in the future as well, even if they have the opposite fault start to occur and they start topping it or hitting it low on the face.
I totally agree with that, because despite me figuring out what I think are optimal ball positions and tee heights for my driver, there are certain days where I could just feel I'm striking it higher on the face or lower on the face, and then I've got to make an adjustment. And it's not going to be with my tee height. It's going to be controlling the arc depth of my swing. Now, am I actually thinking about that? No, but I think I have developed that skill well enough where I could internally just make that athletic adjustment, I would call it, not a mechanical one. That to me makes more sense, just because like I know what golf does. Like you said, moving the tee lower one day might work for one day, but then eventually like the problem will manifest itself in a different way and you're going to have to adjust. So there's two sides to this coin, where it's like we always push people towards more of the skill development because that's a longer term solution. And like you said, sometimes like the low tee height might be a great long term fix, but it might not either.
Skill is both a very short-term fix and at the same time the longest-term fix. It's both at the same time. It's really interesting. But yeah, you know, if I was skying it one day, I'm not going to tee it lower. I'm going to tell myself, all right, just swing a little higher through impact. And I've developed the awareness and the skill to be able to do that. I know lots of people listening to this thinking, well, I can't do that. I don't even understand what that is. Well, this is why you need to develop these things. It can be developed in everybody. Another example, different example of a band-aid that's probably easier to grasp is the slicer who says, oh, I hit it better when I swing it slower. right? And there is a logical reason behind why that might work. Typically, when people try and hit it as hard as they can, typically their body starts to work faster and rotates faster, which leaves the arms lagging behind a little bit more, which can leave the face open. So there's a good logical reason or reasoning behind why hitting it harder tends to, for most people, result in more of a right shot. Doesn't always, but for most people it does. And so people who say, well, I'm swinging slower to help stop that slice, I would put that under Band-Aid because it's a conscious thing. They're consciously adding it and it could hurt something in the future. What could swinging slow hurt? Their distance, their max distance capacity. So I would instead with that player say, well, let's find a different way to close the face. Rather than swinging slower and allowing your arms to catch up with the body, let's find a different way to close that face. Maybe a stronger grip, maybe different wrist angles, maybe trying to present the face more closed. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, those, again, everyone knows I'm not a swing instructor, but if someone came to me with a slice, that's how I would try and fix it. I wouldn't tell anyone they got to swing slower just because I know that doesn't necessarily produce better outcomes. And like you said, you're losing distance. So it's not a logical solution to that problem, in my opinion, either.
Yeah. And again, there are always bell curves with this. I know people could make the extreme argument, well, if someone's swinging 110% and they're falling over, yeah, I mean, in that case, yeah, swinging slower might be a good optimal solution. But for most people, you're looking at golfers who are already swinging really slow, and then they slow it down to the point where their tempo is like 40 beats a minute or something, and it's horrible.
No, if anything, the work I've done and research I've done on tempo tells me that if anything, you know, slowing down is far worse. If anything, people got to learn. Most people have slow backswings in comparison to their downswing, and they're trying to guide the ball. Whereas it's funny what happens when you get people working with the beats to, I don't like to say faster is the word, but if they can get that backswing in a more efficient ratio with the downswing, a lot of good things can happen for certain players. So yeah, slow in my book is usually not good because it starts doing that guided swing, which doesn't usually end well for most players.
Yeah. So whenever I hear that, and it's a very common thing on the lesson tee, whenever I hear I fix this problem by slowing my swing down, I in most cases think of that as a Band-Aid because I'm like, well, you're hitting it better, but you've just cost yourself something as well. There's a cost to your performance. Another example of Band-Aid might be the person who's hooking it left and they come to me and they say, well, I'm trying to swing more in to out to fix it. And that might produce better outcomes for them. Someone who's pull hooking it and they learn to swing more in to out, they may also present the face more open and turn that pull hook into a push draw. And so outcome-wise, it's improved it. You've got the Band-Aid, you've covered up the issue, which is a face that's too close to the path. However, where could that hurt you potentially in the future? Well, as you swing more from the inside, that changes your low point position, and it moves that farther back. So players, once they start doing that too much, they can start to hit lots of fat shots. Now, again, there's a bell curve with this because I know you yourself, John, are in this category, right? You swing in to out and it does make a shallower angle of attack for you, right? When you've been measured, you're usually quite shallow.
People have to be sick of hearing this at this point. They've got to be. It's so weird because like for the 6 years I did my site before we started this podcast, I made it a point to almost never talk about my swing or my golf game. I wanted to make it about the reader. And pretty much in every episode, we are talking about my swing path and shallow angle of attack. And it's I hope I'm not boring people to death with it. But yeah, to get back to your question, like, yes, there is a cost. For me, it's always like, what are you giving up and what are you gaining? And that's a hard question for people to answer. So for me, I don't have many options. I'm playing in a little bit more of an extreme way. It's more of a neutralization. Whereas, you know, going back to our last episode on people taking lessons and doing an overhaul of their swing, I would say the less skilled player could potentially take more drastic options for a long-term fix because they have more to gain from it. And I certainly would implore people to do some of this stuff
with the help of a swing instructor. We always talk about the skill-based stuff, and you don't need a swing instructor to do that, of course, but we're also not against technical changes either. So there's two ways to think about that, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, definitely. As you're saying that, I'm thinking there's this quote that I'm forming in my head. It's something along the lines of, a mechanical fix is the biggest band-aid for a lack of skill. Yes, there it is. It formed in my head as I spoke it. So a mechanical fix is the biggest band-aid for a lack of skill.
Well, give me an example of that. I'm looking at your notes and you have an example of like your worst band-aid. You're saying putting the ball in the back of your stance to deal with lack of weight shift. Like that was your worst example. Is that an example of what you're saying there?
Not my worst, but it's an example. So I suppose to go with that quote, the one about teeing it lower to deal with a skied shot. So, you know, if you've got a person hitting a skied shot, the skill-based way of doing that would be to learn how to control the height that your club enters. You know, can you make it enter higher and can you make it enter lower? That is the skill-based version. And that's going to have the greatest long-term effect because once you've mastered the skill-based version, it's always going to stay with you. Whereas the mechanical fix of maybe teeing it lower, it's going to work, but you're not addressing the lack of skill there. You're not addressing the lack of a person's ability to present the face higher or lower. Or even if you took something like, you know, you got the person who's skying it and you get them set up more behind it, so their angle of attack, they're hitting it more on the upswing. Yes, mechanically, if I give that to 100 golfers who are skying it, you'd see a reduction in the skied shots with that. That is a mechanical fix that works, but it's not addressing, at the same time, it's not addressing that person's skill. And I know long term, the person that doesn't have the skill or the person who's not developing the skill is going to find a new fault in the future, whether it's skying it again or, you know, hitting it low on the face again. And so I'm always trying to develop skill on top of the technique. So that's because technique for me is more of a band-aid. It's more of something that works that will probably fall apart in the future. Or I should say it's more of the quick fix that works now that will fall apart in the future, not necessarily a band-aid.
Let's take a quick break there and we'll be right back.
When you're hiring for your small business, like I have to, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to find the right professionals for your team faster and free. And you can always support us by checking them out at linkedin.com/sweetspot. LinkedIn is not just another job board. It is a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire. I know a ton of people who are using it for multiple reasons, and LinkedIn has absolutely exploded over the last few years. There's wonderful content on business ideas, but more importantly, it gives you access to professionals that you can't find anywhere else. Anyone who runs a small business knows that hiring is easy when you can get that quality candidate. So easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate from LinkedIn Jobs within 24 hours. LinkedIn knows that people like me and other small businesses like Adam or maybe you are wearing so many hats and you might not have the time or resources to hire. It's not like all of us can have our own HR department. That's why there are over 2.5 million small businesses using LinkedIn for hiring. If you want to give it a shot and post your job for free, go to linkedin.com/sweetspot. That's linkedin.com/sweetspot to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And we're back. Is there a way for someone to discern between these two? Because I know a lot of golfers are going at it on their own, and they are trying these different things every week, whether if it's with the help with YouTube or other stuff. How could you distinguish between the band-aid versus I'll call it the more beneficial short-term changes? Is it just looking at skill versus technique, which I know is a recurring theme on this show? Is there any way you have your players figure out the difference between those two? Or is that just too hard of a question to ask?
It's impossible. I mean, you need an instructor, usually. And you need someone with good levels of critical thinking. Because there are so many different examples, right? You can't arm someone to know everything about the mechanics of the swing. But what you can do is improve their critical thinking, which is what I'm trying to do in this podcast here. So the more you can think about certain things and understand the complexities behind them and the interplay between them all, I think you arm yourself better to understand what is going to be a good thing for you and what's going to be a bad thing. So, you know, just to give some more examples, you could talk about clubs and club fitting. You could say that bending the lie angles can be a band-aid. This is interesting because I recently bent my clubs flatter. I'm missing left and I've bent my clubs flatter. It helps me miss the ball left as much. So you could say that is a band-aid. And I would even go and say, yeah, it's almost a band-aid. But it doesn't really negatively affect my performance in any way. I don't have any issues striking the ball. I can still hit the sweet spot. I can still hit the ground in the right place, even though my clubs are coming in more toe down. And it just helps my outcome performance. If anything, it improves it because going into some complexity here, it allows me to present the face more closed, the leading edge more closed, without presenting the 3D face more closed. It actually reduces spin loft and allows me to hit the ball a tiny bit farther, which I could take every ounce of distance that I can get out of it. Now, where I would say it's a bad band-aid is if you get a slicer who's missing right and you bend the clubs toe up an extreme amount. I would say that is a bad band-aid. The other end of the spectrum to what I've done. Now, why? Well, that player is presenting the leading edge open. And if you bend the club toe up, it presents the 3D face left. So those two neutralize each other, but it does so in a way that is horrible for spin loft. So people get very weak shots. They're basically hitting a flop shot with a really toe up club. So it comes out straight. There's not a great amount of oomph in the ball. And so I don't like to see that done. And that is actually something that the industry has done. If you look at most modern clubs, they're very long and very upright these days. And usually that's to alleviate the 90% of slices that are out there. So I don't like to see that one. Whereas the other side of the spectrum, my side of the spectrum, I'm more okay with because of how it changes spin loft. I know lots of people aren't going to understand that. It's a lot of information to take in, but yeah, bending clubs, changing your clubs can be a band-aid that hurts you in the future. And it also hurts different clubs, right? Because say you get a fit for a 7-iron and you find, all right, we've bent these clubs upright, so the toe is up off the ground and you hit the 7-iron straight. Well, unfortunately, when you go to different lofts, you may find that the wedge goes left and the driver still goes to the right. So you might start to get different patterns throughout the bag that become hard to manage because you've used that band-aid with the club. Similarly, if you get fit for a driver, you're a slicer of the ball, you're presenting an open face, a left path, and you get fit for a driver, for example, that helps you straighten out that slice. Well, that's good. It didn't really change the issue, which was your swing, which is presenting the face open to the path. And so you might get better results with the driver, but those irons aren't going to change.
Well, that's often, I've had this conversation with Woody Lashin, who, as many of you know, always comes on the show to talk club fitting. And that's often a question he'll ask a player is like, do you plan on getting lessons? Because sometimes, yeah, he'll see that slicer and say, hey, I could do a few tricks here with the fitting, but he uses the same turn. It's going to be a bit of a band-aid. It's not going to fix the issue. It might alleviate it a little bit, but because he's honest, he'll tell people like, I think your best chance of success is going to fix the core issue. Go get some lessons and see if you can fix that a bit. Sorry, we don't like using the word fix. Neutralize is a better word. and then come back to me, and then we could fit you and your patterns have changed a bit. That's the more, I mean, golfers don't love that answer because it implies more work. They do want that Band-Aid that they think is a quick fix, but it is a Band-Aid. So that comes up a lot. I personally think that, and maybe we have to do more separate shows on the ball flight laws to really like solidify them for people, because I know it's taken really years for me to intuitively understand them. Once you could really start to understand why the golf ball is flying through the air a certain way, and then troubleshoot that back to the impact conditions, I think that that would help so many golfers stop spinning their wheels on the range and be able to, again, are they as good as working with a professional? No, but they can be a little bit better of their own swing doctor, where they can understand like, hey, my ball is curving from left to right. Swinging more to the left is probably not going to fix that issue. It's probably going to make it worse. Like, I need to figure out to make a better relationship with my path and face angle, reduce the extremity of my swing path, understand if it's the driver, how strike location plays into that. So yeah, the ball flight laws aren't super complicated, but to get a good grasp on them, and when you do, I think that could open up a lot of doors for people.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, if you're getting club fit, it's, I'm not going to say it's always a bad thing, right? You can get certain club fits that are going to help alleviate your issues. I don't want to make people run out and think that every club fit is a bad thing. No, changing your lie angles is often very good for you. It's just, you know, I wouldn't want to see someone just bend those clubs really, really upright for someone who's slicing it in all cases, because it's a conscious thing. It alleviates the issue, but it might not get to the underlying reason or the underlying core thing, which is the definition of a Band-Aid.
You remember those drivers that they, I mean, I don't know how long ago this was, but obviously it failed. Remember they were selling drivers like for slicers, the anti-slice driver that had the face pointing like super left at impact? That is like the classic example of an equipment Band-Aid. It didn't work out. They no longer really sell those, but that kind of came to mind. I don't know if you remember those.
I've never tried it, so I didn't know whether it worked or not. But you get it with modern day clubs, right? We can move the center of mass location around. So depending on who you ask as to why that works, I think Woody says it works for a combination of reasons. So say you put the weight on the club into the heel. I think it helps slicers because some people say it allows you to rotate the face more. So it encourages more of a closed face at impact. And some people say, well, no, it just changes the center of mass location on the face. So a centered strike now becomes more of a toe strike. And so you get more toe gearing. So that could be an example of a Band-Aid, right? Where you just move the location of the weight on the club to affect it. And why is it a Band-Aid? Because it fixes the outcome issue, but it means you're not really hitting the sweet spot anymore. You're hitting more of the toes, again, toe gearing. And you'd have to decide whether that's something you want to do or not. For many people, it could be great, and it might not affect their other parts of their game. But for some people, I found that when I had these irons that I was hitting left, I was starting to put things into my iron swing, whether consciously or not, that would make the ball go more right. And then that started to influence my driver. My driver started to go more right. So, you know, one was affecting the others. Whereas now when I have the clubs more toe down, I'm hitting it more consistently throughout the bag. So I don't have to think of different things. There's no right or wrong with this. You just have to have a serious discussion with your club fitter, have a bit of critical thinking and see where the club fits, whether it's going to be a Band-Aid that hurts you in the future or whether it's going to be something that, yeah, just it works and it doesn't affect other parts of your performance.
Yeah, and of course you have to consider time, which we always keep bringing up, is that for some players, they're like, yeah, I don't have the time to fix this, so do what you can. Maybe it can help a little bit on the course because I just don't have the time to get lessons and change this pattern. That's where, you know, a good club fitter would help make that distinction, is that they ask these questions to the players about, are you working with a swing instructor? How often do you practice? And if all the answers are no, no, and no, they'll say, okay. Like I said earlier, you could slap some things together and fix it a little bit, but it's not going to totally solve the underlying issue. So that's the trade-off for a lot of things outside of golf as well. So you have to really think about do you have the time to solve the root cause of the issue, which is a lot deeper than that? And a Band-Aid is not going to do that.
Here's an interesting one, again, on the club fitting line. So say you have, as is typical, a golfer who is hitting their driver and they're hitting it very low. Maybe they're launching it 7-8 degrees, and you can see they're hitting down on it, maybe 5 degrees or so. So you could say there, well, from a club fitting perspective, you could take that golfer and just jack up the loft, you know, take them from a 9 or 10 degree head and give them, I mean, what is it? I've seen as much as 15 degree drivers, maybe even more. So you could give them something like that and give them a whippier shaft that maybe kicks early. I'm probably exposing my lack of club fitting knowledge here, but, you know, give them something that gets around that angle of attack that's excessively down. They're presenting less loft. So that would be a Band-Aid because it gets the outcome that you want, and it does it very quickly. It gets the ball to launch higher, so they may pick up distance. However, you've just given a person, someone who's got a downward angle of attack, a lot of loft, and so their spin loft is very high. They're not going to be getting maximum energy out of it. Whereas I know if I took that same player and didn't change their club loft, so they're hitting it very low, but I changed their technique, I got them hitting more up on it, now they'll be launching it higher with less spin loft, and they'll be getting closer to their true maximum carry. So you could say the jacking the loft up thing is a Band-Aid, whereas changing the angle of attack is more of the, I don't want to say correct fix, but it's certainly more optimal in terms of maximizing distance or getting close to that physics-based maximum. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I was actually, I think it was Mark Brody's son who works for Ping. I think his name is Chris. Hopefully I don't have that wrong. I came across some of that research where they were talking about optimal drivers. It's similar to what's going on with Bryson. So Bryson is playing with a 5.5 degree driver. And because he swings so fast, the more loft they add, it's just going to spin too much. Like you said, they found this true in their research, the more optimal way to hit that high launching drive with less spin is with more attack angle, because it accomplishes both. It adds more loft, but it does not add more spin.
Yeah.
So that could be the issue for a lot of players, is that, yeah, if you're hitting down on it or de-lofting it or something like that, adding loft could make it launch higher, but then you might get those high spinners at the expense of distance.
Gives you performance in one area, but at the expense of the other. So yeah, when you jack up the loft, it improves the launch angle part of the equation, but it reduces the spin rate and the smash factor part of the equation. And there was actually a chart done by TrackMan a few years ago where they show, you know, your optimal distance that you can hit, and it was based on your angle of attack. And that was more of a club fitting chart. So it would say, if you've got a -5 angle of attack, the most you could hit it is this if you get these numbers. Lots of people misconstrued that, and they say, oh, well, that's my maximum distance. I'm like, no, if you hit it, if you change your swing and you hit more up on it, you can actually achieve these different maximums.
And that could go in the opposite direction too. It's such a crazy game because, you know, we talked about in our driver episode how to get maximum distance. Like, you know, a lot of players will kind of tilt their shoulders up so they can hit more up on the ball and kind of get their weight back a little bit. And then a listener of the podcast was sending me some pictures of his GC quad info. He's talking about his driver and just asking my opinion. I could see that his loft at impact was like 28 degrees. The shaft, he had reverse shaft lean because he's like, yeah, I was trying to exaggerate that move. And my instructor saw that. I'm like, yeah, you're just adding way too much loft. And it sounded like his instructor agreed. So it could go in opposite directions. You could have a fix with good intentions, but if you exaggerate it too much, well, then that golfer's adding way too much loft and they're hitting these kind of weaker drives with too much spin. So it's a complicated game.
Yeah, anything can be overdone. Apart from controlling the face, controlling the ground contact, and controlling the sweet spot straight. You can't overdo those things. That's why we're big on those. I wanted to go through some examples of Band-Aids that are not necessarily bad. Maybe not Band-Aids that people usually lump under the Band-Aid thing.
Why don't we start calling them short-term solutions?
Yeah.
Faster solutions, because we're getting into some wordplay here, which is always what happens in golf.
And while it may be philosophical as to whether these are or not, I suppose there's a bell curve. So say the example of someone who slices the ball. Say they slice it 20 yards in the air, right? And then I say, well, why don't you just aim down the left-hand side? Lots of people will come back to that and they say, well, that's just a Band-Aid. Now, you could easily argue, well, no, that's not a Band-Aid. That's using strategy, using your alignment to get more of your shots on the target. You could say in one regard it's a Band-Aid because the ball's curving, you're aiming down the left-hand side, you're still hitting the big curve. So, yeah, whenever we curve the ball too much, we're probably losing efficiency, right? Because if you're curving the ball too much, you're not having a direct hit on the ball.
The straightest ball flight is the longest ball flight.
Yeah, it tends to be.
That's the trade-off there.
Tends to be, yeah. However, pros do it. Every pro out there curves the ball. I mean, you see sometimes when you're watching TV, they'll hit the shot and they'll tell you a little decal will come up saying the curve of the shot. I don't know if you've ever seen that. And you can see guys like Rory and Dustin, they can curve it like 90 foot, 100 foot in the air, which is what, 30, 40 yards or so. So these guys can curve the ball significant amounts and still hit the fairway. They're not all hitting laser beam straight shots, especially not all the time. So it's not necessarily a Band-Aid, that one. It doesn't necessarily have a negative connotation to it, a negative effect on other parts of your performance. That's one example, using strategy to deal for your patterns. Lots of people lump it under Band-Aid. I would say no. But you can get a side of the bell curve where if someone's curving it 60, 80 yards in the air and you get them to aim 80 yards left, now I would say, all right, yeah, that's a Band-Aid. You should probably fix the slice. But, you know, if it's 20 yards in the air, that's not a big issue.
It always goes back to me is that better golf is avoiding extremes. So there's always a line in the sand between like what you're describing sounds more functional to me. Like, yeah, if we know this golfer has a tendency to shape the ball left to right that much, then yeah, adjusting their aim might make sense to compensate for that. But there gets to a point where it's so extreme that you can't curve the ball 80 yards through the trees.
Yeah.
There's just certain things that are not, or especially if it's windy out or something like that. Like there's always a point of diminishing returns where you're like, okay, now we need to go into neutralization mode.
You can start to get into the situation where if, say, you're swinging 10 degrees left and you've got a face that's open and you're hitting your 7-iron on target. The problem with that is if you do that exact same swing with a driver, it slices right. And the exact same swing with a wedge, it finishes left because the ball's curving different amounts in the air. So you can start to get different patterns with different clubs when you go to too extreme with the path and face differentiation. So yeah, that's why I don't like to see extremes. I don't push everybody towards neutral. But at the same time, I don't like to see people with extremes. You can go back to our previous episode to listen to what I feel is necessary to get a scratch in that regard with path and face. We talk a lot about clubbing up, aiming to give yourself a buffer. If the pin is 150, don't pull out the club that you hit 150 if you strike it perfectly. Right? So this is an interesting one that I would call a medium Band-Aid, is clubbing up. So, for example, if I'm 150 away, I tend to hit my 155 club or 160 club. Why? Because I know I'm not going to strike it perfect every time. So if I strike it perfectly, it'll go 160. Big deal. You leave yourself a 30-footer. If I strike it average, it's going to fall and it's going to be closer. And then I can strike it pretty poorly before it falls more than 10 yards short of the flag. So you could say that, or someone might say, if you tell them, we'll just club up, they might say, well, isn't that just a Band-Aid for me striking it, not striking it perfect?
I'd call it accepting reality.
Yes, yeah, exactly, exactly. You have to accept a certain amount of misstrike. We're not going to strike everything perfect. Where it may become a Band-Aid is if you're clubbing up two or three clubs to deal with the fact you're hitting it 2 inches behind. That's where you'd say, right, let's, instead of just clubbing up here, let's address the issue of you hitting it 2 inches behind. And let's, instead of Band-Aiding it by whacking an extra two clubs, let's work on ground contact. There's a bell curve there.
Yeah, there's always, like I said earlier, I think there's always a line. It's hard for everyone to always know exactly what that line is, but like what you described earlier, like, yeah, if you're hitting it 6 inches behind the ball and you're taking more club to compensate for that, like that's a lot different than saying like, oh, I average, you know, the pin's 145 and if I hit it on like the lower to medium end range of my 7 iron, I will clear that. Like that's more functional and efficient in my opinion. I wouldn't call that, if we're using the word band-aid, I think that's just adjusting for your tendencies and being honest with them is how I'd describe that.
Yeah, exactly. So that's where it's, I'd call this a medium, or it could be, or it couldn't be a band-aid. Similar with the slice pattern or the hook pattern, right? When you start to adjust for your tendencies, there's a point where it's not a band-aid and a point where it probably becomes that point where we say, right, yeah, let's address the big curvature here. Or let's address the 2-3 inches behind that you're doing. Some other examples of this that could be, couldn't be band-aids, setting up out of the toe to deal with a shank. It's possible. I usually try and get people to change it through intentionality, but I personally, I'm the reverse. I tend to have a toe bias contact, and I've learned to set up out of the heel. I've noticed a few people pick up on it and they say, oh, you're setting up out of the heel. I'm like, yeah, that's because I tend to hit it out of the toe. So I just set about the heel, make my normal swing, and I strike it centered. Lots of people could say, well, that's just a band-aid. Well, I've got a collage of loads of professionals who do this as well. Some really good players like Annika Sorenstam used to set up out of the heel of the club. You know, probably the greatest lady professional ever. There are loads of guys who set up out of the toe and the heel who are playing elite level golf. Is it a band-aid? Or is it just something you can do? There's no rule that says you have to set up right at the center of the club. If it helps your performance, it's not necessarily a problem. And if I see someone do that, if someone comes to me and they say, oh, I've been shanking it all my life and I found just setting up out the toe really helps me, I'll say, yeah, go for it. That's not necessarily a bad thing.
I mean, this is a results-based game, so I would pay attention to the results over the long term. I've made small changes like that that have stayed with me for a really long time, and now they're just parts of my game. That example, that does not work for me, the setting up at I'm a heel striker.
It doesn't, yeah, doesn't work for everybody.
It doesn't work for me. I'm more of like consciously trying to strike it on the toe would help me better. But that's something I've kind of figured out over time through experimentation and trying it. Most golfers don't even think about this stuff.
Yeah, I prefer to go the conscious route with someone so they develop their control and their skill over it. But like I said, if someone says, I'm setting about out the toe and I strike it on the center, I'll say, all right, we'll monitor it. But I'm fine with that as an instructor.
Yeah, go for it. If it's working, go for it.
Yeah. Similarly, something that you and I both do is setting up with the face, maybe more open or closed at address.
Oh, that's something that definitely I do. Yeah. Me setting up with the face, flashing it open a little bit at impact is like, I got a new hybrid from Woody. Apologies to Woody for this, but it was the way it was set up, the lie angle, it looked closed at impact for me. Or at least to my eye, and I texted him. I said, I cannot play golf with this. I just can't do it.
Close the address.
And he's like, fine. Yeah, it was right. It looked close the address on me. He's like, fine. This is against my wishes, but you can adjust the lie angle a little more flat. And I did, and the thing looked square at impact for me. Because for me, I'm very peculiar about that. That's interesting that you bring that up. Like, I need that face flashing a little bit open for me. That's a huge cue for me in my setup.
Yeah, so, and I'm the same. If I start hitting it left, sometimes I'll just say, right, I'm just going to set up with the face a little bit more open at address. And that can help alleviate my left shot. Now, everybody would say, well, that's just a band-aid. Well, I would argue no, because a band-aid to me is something that's going to have a negative effect later on. This was going to have no negative effects. Just setting up with the face open a little bit, that's not going to hurt your game. It achieves the result, it improves your performance, and it doesn't have necessarily any negative connotations on the back end of it. So I'm fine with that. Similarly, if you're a slicer and you want to set up with the face a little closed at address, I'm fine with that as well. Again, there's no rule saying that you have to set up with the leading edge very square. Absolutely no rule. Most of these things are just, again, it's that human trait that we want everything to be symmetrical and textbook. And it's just like, you know what? Just get the job done. At some point, just get it done. And I've been both players. In my youth, I was that perfectionist. And now I'm just like, whatever works, man. Just, it has to be adaptable. It's going to be changeable from day to day. Some days I set up with it a little bit more open. Some days I set up with it squarer. I'm responding to my patterns. I'm getting the job done on the day.
Yeah, I bet there's plenty of examples. I mean, we can't go on forever about this, but putting comes to mind because that's a part of the game where you can have even more peculiarities, if that's the right word.
Well, with Tiger like setup. And so
he was trying to like hook his putts, right?
Well, Tiger Woods is notorious. When he was measured, he set up with the face 3 degrees open every time. Yeah. Now, that might have been, it might have been a conscious thing from him. I doubt it. It was probably more of an unconscious thing. But, you know, maybe he had a swing and he was pulling them early on in his life and he figured out unconsciously, well, if I set it up open with the face, then that pull now is a straight shot. And so lots of people would look at that and say, oh, well, that's a band-aid, right? He's setting up with the face open at address and then he's having a rapid rate of closure through impact. Lots of people say it's a band-aid. He was one of the best putters in the world at that point. I mean, this was when he was holding everything in like 2001.
Yeah, if you are addressing, this is why I brought up the ball flight laws, is because if you're looking at your ball flight, or let's say putting is different because it's all about the face angle and impact, you're pulling the putts, or let's say for you and me, we like to flash the face open a bit because we don't want to pull the ball. That is a functional matchup that addresses a ball flight issue. And if your ball is curving through the air in a more functional way with that small little change, that is essentially what my, that is what's brought me to this point in golf.
Yeah.
Is a lot of these small changes in ball flight. I certainly do unorthodox things with my technique to get there, but I guess these are all little small fixes or changes I've made over the year that I just keep looking at my ball flight and work backwards. So these are the ones that make more sense to me and resonate more with my game because there's a specific purpose for them. They're not just aesthetic.
And like I said, as long as it doesn't have a negative effect in your game later on, it's not going to be an issue. It's just something that's not orthodox. It's just something that's not textbook. But big deal, big deal. You can have a textbook looking swing and hit it off the planet. You could have a swing like Jim Furyk and pummel it down the center every time. You know, it's, well, not every time, but you get the idea.
He hit a lot of fairways.
Yeah, yeah. So something in my game that, again, may be considered or might be considered by some as a band-aid is I've always, as a junior, swung to the top and then I drop the club under plane and I would hit this big old hook. My path would be in to out. Now, it was part conscious, part unconscious, figured out that if I take it outside the line on the way back, so you can imagine kind of a Matt Wolf-esque takeaway. I'm not that extreme, but I certainly, my hands move away from my body in the backswing as I do my takeaway. What happens then is I take it outside the line on the backswing and drop it onto plane in the downswing.
Yeah, you're just changing the reference point in the swing.
Yeah, and lots of people would say, well, that's just a band-aid. And I would argue, well, I've been doing that for probably 10 years now, and I'm playing the best golf. I've been playing the best golf of my life since doing that. So yes, it made my swing look a little less orthodox. It doesn't fit in with the textbook model, but who cares? It didn't cause me any long-term issues. In fact, it helped me, and it stayed there. It stayed there long-term, that the help has. So yeah, these certain things I want people to understand that not everything that goes against textbook is necessarily a band-aid that's going to fall apart. You can aim down the left side to compensate for a 20 yard slice. You could club up a little bit to compensate for an average strike or to compensate for it. You could take the club outside the line to compensate for dropping under plane. You can set up with the face slightly open at address to alleviate a hook. So all these things are just options. As I said, when it becomes a band-aid is when it negatively affects something else or gets around a problem. Like we said, with teeing it lower when you're skying it, it's getting around a lack of skill there.
So you also have, I'm looking at your notes here. Apologies if I jumped the gun on you. You did want to talk about compensations too. Have we gone into that yet, or do we want to wrap up that part of the conversation?
Almost, yeah. I said compensations a few times there, and as I was saying it, I'm like, oh, am I going too far here? I just want to wrap up the Band-Aid one with a skill-based one. I mean, we've done a whole episode on this, but I just want to really highlight that lots of people say skill development is a Band-Aid for poor technique. I would argue the opposite. I would say improving your technique is a Band-Aid for skill. I did not word that better, because I know lots of people would say, how can improving your technique be a bad thing? I didn't say that. But I would say that improving your technique or changing something in your technique is going to be less long-lasting than if you are to improve your skill. We've done whole episodes on that, so I just want to leave with that. People can listen to those episodes and skill versus technique and all that.
And a reminder that this show is evergreen. So if this is your first, second, or third episode, you're with us. Everything in our library is not, we don't have any order. It's just all things that we think can help you play better at golf. So if you go back to our first episode, 10th episode, they're all relevant today as they were back then.
Yeah. Let me give a concrete example of that. So say you've got a slicer, right? Got a guy on the lesson tee, slice, 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 slice. I change his grip. We strengthen it from weaker to stronger. So we do a mechanical change. And in the lesson, he hits it straighter. Well, he might come back a week later, and this has happened. This has happened several times. He might come back a week later and he's found a new way to slice it. You know, now he's okay, he's taking a stronger grip at address, but now he's cupping his wrist more at the top or early downswing, or he's reduced his forearm roll through impact for whatever reason. They might not logically be able to find it, and now he's slicing it again. This happens more than you would know about. And probably people listening to this have experienced this, where they've changed something mechanical, either on their own regard or in a lesson. It's improved them then, and then they find a new way of getting the old fault. The slice comes back. That's why I say a technical change can be more of a Band-Aid, more of a short-term thing that doesn't hold up. Whereas if I got a player to learn how to present the face differently through intention, so we go through a skill development based exercise, present the face closed, a little bit, a lot, a medium amount, and we go through this skill development exercise, so they're gaining awareness, they're gaining control, they're gaining feel over it. When a player masters those skills, they are going to be able to figure out on their own the way to fix their slice for the rest of their life. So that is why it's more robust. Whereas people reverse it, they say skill is a Band-Aid. I'm saying no, it can be the reverse. You could easily argue that it's the reverse. Right. I've dropped the mic on skill development there, on the Band-Aid stuff.
I think we both agree it's a teach a man or a woman to fish scenario.
Exactly, yeah. That's a nice way to summarize it. So compensations then. Let's move on to the next one. Compensations. What does the word compensation mean?
I mean, to me, like if I'm thinking about, maybe this isn't golf related, but in sports and injuries, like let's say you had something wrong with your left knee and then you start making compensations in your body to accommodate that pain, then something else pops up in your body. So it's like you're changing your patterns in whatever you're doing, and then something else pops up and it doesn't fix the initial issue. It creates a whole new different one. Whereas perhaps the smartest solution all along was to get that left knee fixed. That is not golf related, obviously, but for whatever reason that popped in my head.
Yeah, I mean, it's looking at the definition now, it's almost like the word compensate means to give someone something like money, to make up for loss, injury, or suffering, to make up for mistakes or wrongdoing. I think in the way that it's projected in golf, you know, someone may do something in their swing early on that's not textbook, and then they do something later on to, in air quotes, make up for that earlier mistake.
I'm definitely making compensations in my swing.
Well, exactly. There are definite things where this could be bad. But I think the problem with the word compensation is people, instructors especially, use it as a way of pushing the agenda of perfect swing mechanics. You know, this idea of one model swing. You know, and if you veer from this model, it's a compensation or it's a fault which requires a compensation. And people buy into that. People lap that stuff up. But the problem with that is a swing model is largely a made-up thing by humans. Now, it's not to say there aren't things in swing mechanics that every good player does possess. You know, you look at most professionals or all professionals, and they all do things like, you know, they sequence a certain way, they shift their weight. So there are certain things in mechanics that we should all strive towards doing. However, there, and you can just pick up any book, any golf book, and they all have different models. A Jimmy Ballard model might be different to a stack and tilt model. I shouldn't say stack and tilt model. I don't know enough about them. I think they class themselves more as a system, but you get the idea. There might be more left-sided models. There might be more weight-shifty models. There might be models where Jim Hardy has the kind of one-plane swing or the two-plane swing. So there's these different models, and it's impossible to say, well, what is a fault then if there are different models? I almost strongly dislike the word compensation in a way, because it insinuates that one way of doing it. So let's give an example, right? Or a couple of examples. Someone takes it away on the inside. So they take away, they swing, and the club goes a little inside. Is that you? That's you, isn't it?
Here we're doing it again.
Okay. So you take it away on the inside. Hey, I take it away on the outside. So someone looking at cause and effect, looking at logical chain, could say that I take it away on the outside and I compensate by dropping it on the inside. Or you could even argue the opposite, right? I drop it on the inside in the downswing, so I compensate by taking it on the outside. Well, is it really a compensation?
Yeah, I guess the question is, like, compared to what?
Yeah, or is it just a different way of doing it? And that's the thing. There are so many different ways to do this. I'm not saying everything goes. I know people will argue, oh, Adam's saying anything goes in the golf swing. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is there's a lot of room for flair and individuality in the golf swing that's not necessarily a bad thing. I post Matt Wolff's swing. I did an analysis of his swing a couple of years ago, and I always get on Facebook the comments, oh yeah, he's compensating for this and that. I'm like, it's not a compensation. Matt Wolff is not compensating for anything. He just has a different way of doing it. Just because he takes it away on the outside on the backswing and then has this huge rotation through impact, it doesn't mean he's compensating. He's just found a different model. Similarly, Dustin Johnson has a very strong grip, closes the face even more at the top of his swing by having a bowed lead wrist, and then he has a lot of rotation and a hold-off release, a lack of supination through impact, to, some people would say, to compensate for the closed face in the backswing. Compensation having a negative connotation to it. I would say Dustin Johnson's just doing it a different way. That's all. It's not compensating for anything. He's just found different matchups.
I'm not someone who has ever... The golf swing, or at least, you know, the technical study of the golf swing, never really interested me much. Like, all of those swing theories you were talking about, I've never researched them. I never really read books on the golf swing. I just wasn't all that interested in a kid, because I was always someone in athletics who would kind of figure out a way to do things my own way. So I'm more of that Matt Wolff type guy. Like, I was a pretty good shooter in basketball, but the way I delivered the basketball was not similar to other people. So I've always kind of been an outside the box person when it comes to athletics. So yeah, I mean, you're speaking my language when you talk that, because that's how I've always approached it. And I never really, talking to so many people in the golf industry, as I've been involved in it the last 7+ years, you know, I think people get very territorial on their ideas as it relates to the swing. And also, I think from a commercial standpoint, in order to stand out, it's easier to stand out when you have a quote unquote system, because then you could package that up and sell it. You know, not that there's anything wrong with that. You know, people are trying to make a living, and I'm sure there's plenty of golfers who have benefited from these systems. But to say that my system is correct and yours is not, and I've heard this before many times in private conversations, I don't roll my eyes at them in front of them because I'm trying to be polite, but in my head, I'm like, that's just not true. I do not believe that fundamentally. So yeah, I don't, like when you talked about Matt Wolf starting all the way on the outside, I said, in relation to what? Like people draw that line, you know, there's always these lines they draw on these swing videos. I'm like, why does that line have to be 45 degrees and perfect?
Exactly. Like on the plane? Yeah. Why? Why?
Like, was there a tablet that we unearthed in Scotland?
And no one's questioning it, right?
To me, it's... All right. I'm going to really try and not go down the philosophical rabbit hole here, but I think that's what humans try and do. The golf swing is like a super complex movement, and we're just trying to make rational sense of it. And a lot of that is like just drawing these lines and being like, hey, you're under it or over it, and you better be on it.
Exactly. And it's just, why don't we question these things enough?
Well, I think people are now. I think as we have more advanced tools to understanding like what creates functional matchups or impact laws, like I think there's more of that going on. But you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago when all these systems were coming up, there was just less accurate information available.
Yeah. I mean, most of these things, lots of these models are man-made theory, and lots of it is just based on symmetry. The perfect takeaway in air quotes, where you take the club back and it's perfectly lined up with your foot position when your feet position is perfectly parallel to the target. Both of those things, both foot alignment and takeaway relative to that is a man-made concept. There's no law in golf that says you have to aim your feet perfectly square at the target. People accept that as gospel.
People always say like square club face at impact. I mean, that could be horrible for certain players.
Yeah, anybody who has a slightly in to out or out to in path, a square club face is going to perform worse for you. And pros don't present a square face at impact. They present it slightly open or slightly closed to match what their path is doing.
But it makes sense why someone would say that square and straight sound good in golf. But if I presented the face square at impact, I'd be hitting pull hooks every time. And someone who with the opposite swing pattern, they'd be hitting push slices.
Well, there's a symmetry argument, right? Is that you would say that, okay, if a pro or you are 2 degrees in to out and you present the face 1 degree open, they could say, well, you're compensating for your in to out path by opening the face.
But damn right I am.
Yeah, but this it's not a compensation. You're only compensating if you believe that a neutral path is better. Or more or better for you. And it's not. It's not necessarily. There's no argument for why it would be, really. Especially not if you're, you know, if you're only 2, 3, 4 degrees in to out. Okay, when we get to extremes and more neutral path would be better. But there's that bell curve again. So you can almost only have a compensation if you first have a model in mind, right? Because if you don't have a model and you're not really compensating for anything, it's just a different way of doing it. Now, are there boundaries that I like to see a swing stay within? Yes. But my boundaries are a hell of a lot wider than most teachers, most players, most books, and most magazines will promote.
If I were teaching the swing, I'd be actually happier with someone who was on one side of the spectrum with their swing path rather than neutral, just because they could maybe see one ball flight in particular, and then they wouldn't be tempted to try and work it both ways. I try and look at the swing with no model in mind. And yeah, I just see, even in the tournaments I play, I see so many different types of, and more unorthodox looking swings than you would think. I mean, I know everyone gets to see what's going on TV, but you know, no one is televising local amateur events with a bunch of, you know, scratch plus handicaps. These are all great players, but it's interesting when you watch all of them play is that you see far less quote unquote pretty swings than you would think. There's a lot more unorthodox stuff going on than anyone would imagine. And that's, you know, when we did our episode on scratch golf was one of the things I wanted to get across, that like, there's nothing magical that these golfers are doing in the sense that like, they don't look like Adam Scott. They're just really good at, you could call it compensation, whatever the heck you want, is creating these functional relationships. And they have all these little tricks that they do. It could be flashing the face open like we talked about, or it's, you know, different things. But they don't all look the same. They're very, very, very different.
Well, more people. I think with the term matchups, that's why I like the term matchups, because it's floating around, it's getting in people's heads. So people are starting to understand that, oh, maybe there's not this one perfect way, and anything that veers from it is a fault which requires a compensation. That's been the gospel prior to this more matchups-led revolution. So I like the idea of matchups now, where people are starting to think a little bit more about, oh, maybe there are more options, and maybe compensations are not actually compensations, but they're just different sets of matchups. So I like the way it's heading with that. I just wouldn't want people to start thinking that there are optimal sets of matchups as well, because then you're opening up the worst part of the model swing era, and you're applying it to the new era.
This is why I do not video my golf swing ever. Yeah. Cause I just do not care. I want to look at that golf ball and see what it's doing, and make my, I guess Tiger always talked about feels, and a lot of other golfers do, but that's, I just have all these reference points and feels and adjustments I make to make that little white ball travel a little bit better through the air than it was prior. So it's complicated, because I don't think, it's so hard to arm when we talk about the matchups. Like, that's a very tall order to ask a recreational golfer to understand how all that works together. That takes years and years and years of someone like yourself or Shaheen, who we had on our last episode, to learn those matchups and then communicate them and see on the fly what's going to work for a certain golfer. So that's why we constantly talk more about the skill development stuff, because those are more exercises and drills that you could do at home or at the range that can have meaningful benefits on your game, versus, you know, just videoing your swing and being like, hey, how does my takeaway look with the top of my swing and my downswing? Like, that's a very tall, I can't do that with my own swing as much as I've learned about the swing. I don't even try and do it.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of what you can do in educating golfers, I understand that, you know, training them to understand all the different matchups is going to be an impossible task. You have to have a huge golf mental library. But what you can help golfers understand is options. So, you know, you base it around the big three faults, and you'd say, just to take an example, okay, if you are slicing, if you are missing it right, here are the options. You could do this Absolutely. With your grip, you could do this with the setup position of the club face, and you could do this with the forearm rotation at the bottom, supination. You could do this with your wrist angles at the top. So those are four options for people. So you're basically building tools for them. And then out of those tools, you could say, well, this one works best for you based on, or this one is a better idea based on your other patterns. So you can start to layer on these things. And that's how I train my players. So they're learning these different tools. They're learning these different options. And I also might tell them, well, what is not a good option? Because yeah, there are certain things that you don't want to do. Like, for example, if that player is slicing it, I don't want to tell them that slowing down your swing is an option, because yes, while that might work, I don't like that option. I don't feel it optimizes your performance and gives you the highest peak capacity as a golfer, whereas changing your wrist angles or doing something at the bottom might be a better option or matchup. So people can understand options, and you can start with just one option. You know, okay, you're slicing it, here's one option for you that you can fix. Go around and play with that for a week. Next week,
yeah, close the face, or try and hit a hook, which would be adjusting your swing path. There's two options there. Not necessarily like, oh, go video your swing and look at, you know, your eight positions that you're hitting. That is not how a golfer self-corrects. You know, you want to work with an instructor and they do that stuff, great. If they can lead you to the promised land, go for it. But usually not going to happen on your own that way. Do we want to start wrapping up here? Is there more you want to talk about?
Well, I still want to go through some examples of compensations that are fine.
Okay.
And what I would not consider compensation. And then some that are true compensations. Because this category exists. There are some things you could do in your swing that are bad. That I wouldn't say there's necessarily a swing model, but it may hurt you in the future. So, you know, some examples are not compensations, in my opinion. Matt Wolff's takeaway, he's not compensating for anything. Dustin Johnson, you know, the way he swings through impact, he's not compensating for a closed face. It's just a different way of doing it. On the other end of the scale, Webb Simpson has a strong grip. He cups his lead wrist at the top to open it. They're not compensating pieces. They're just different ways of doing it. There are plenty of players who have done that in the past. Lee Westwood, this is more complicated, but some players through impact, right, they will spring up more with their body and use straighter arms. Okay, so that's a set of matchups that exists. It's quite common on tour. Tiger would be an example of that. Gets that lead shoulder working up really hard through impact and has very straight arms through impact. You could even argue that the lead shoulder working up is what straightens the arm. Whereas you have other players like Lee Westwood, his body, he covers it more with his chest. If you can imagine, through impact, he keeps his chest down through impact more. And he actually folds his left arm through impact, bends it quite significantly. And there are lots of players who do that as well on tour. Again, you could say that Lee Westwood is bending his arm to compensate for his lead shoulder not moving up. Or you could just say, it's just a different way of doing it. You know, most people would say, oh, straight arms are a model way of doing it. You'd have to really sit that person down and say, okay, explain me why. Explain why a straighter lead arm is better than what Lee Westwood is doing. And actually, if you go deep enough into that conversation, their argument will break down. Because it's not. Are there bell curves of that? Yes, of course. I would say there's even a bell curve with a straight arm. If you're forcing your lead arm straight, you can create more forearm injuries. But I don't want to see someone completely collapse their arm. You know, if they've got the butt of their club in their chest at impact, then that's not a good thing either. As I said, there are lots of things in the golf swing that people deem compensations. There are just different ways of doing it.
Yeah, like John Rahm, they're saying his short backswing because he's got to fire those hips open as a compensation for his short backswing. But that's just what that's what he's doing, and it's working pretty damn well. So
yeah.
You can call it whatever you want.
So what then, in my opinion, would be a true compensation? You know, something where you're doing something to compensate for something bad. By the way, with the term compensation, I didn't mention this, but compensations are usually unconscious. Whereas band-aids are a conscious thing. You know, someone is saying, right, I'm trying to do this. Compensations are more, they kind of unconsciously self-organize, right? So true compensations, bad things, might be someone who has a poor weight shift, right? So they're going to hit it fat. They're not shifting their weight forward, so their low point is behind. They're going to hit it fat. And then they swing significantly to the left, you know, out to in to compensate for that. Because most people don't know, but if you swing left, that actually moves the low point forwards. So you can imagine this player on their back foot with a low point behind swings left, which moves the low point forward. They get now good ground contact, but they've just created a little mess for themselves because now their path is way left. Again, a little of this is not the end of the world. If your path is 3-4 degrees left, nothing to worry about. But if your path is 15 left, like I've seen some people, they're on their back foot and they're swinging 15 degrees left, that can be an issue. Another example that people can relate because they listen to our podcast, we talk about it all the time, gear effect. Imagine a player who is slicing it, so they swing significantly left with an open face, they hit slices, and then they learn to hit it on the toe because that adds some toe gear effect. Now that ball comes out dead straight. But it's not efficient because if you're swinging 15 degrees left with an open face and hitting the toe, you've just used three things. They're all compensating for each other that reduces the efficiency in the ball. You're going to get horrible spin rates. You're going to get lower smash factors. And it's not going to help you in other parts of your game as well. When you get a wedge in your hand, you're going to get lots of pull shots. So yeah, it just makes it less efficient overall. Something that I actually do, I tend to have an earlier release of the club. Do you know what that means?
I functionally know what it means when I'm trying to sky a wedge over a tree. I'm just letting my right hand pass my left one a little earlier to add loft versus my typical pattern is I feel like I know I'm de-lofting and I'm kind of holding that wrist angle more forward, forward shaft lean.
Yeah, you might call it adding loft. Some people would say it's scooping. How I define it is when does, if you're looking at a face-on video, so you imagine you're looking straight on at the player's chest, where does that club shaft cross over the lead forearm? That is what I would consider the release point. And so for professionals, that happens after impact with irons. I add a little bit too much loft to it. It's just something that I naturally do. Lots of players do. I've compensated, in air quotes, by shifting my weight more forwards, because that earlier release actually makes you contact the ground earlier as well as adding loft. Whereas I've found unconsciously, if I shift my weight more forwards, I can still do that early release, but I can still get forward shaft lean and get that low point forwards. So now, again, this is a bell curve thing, right? Is it necessarily a bad thing? I would say, within reason, no. I would say what I do, the amount I do, is okay. It's manageable. But if it got more than that, it might create some other issues. You know, you're reducing, or sorry, increasing spin loft, so you're not getting the same compression on it. There are some other more complicated things that happen. So, you know, whenever I'm hitting the ground early, yes, I have these options. I could shift my weight forwards more, or I could produce a later release. I usually go for the later release option because I know that's the better matchup for me, the better option. It stops me compensating by shifting my weight forwards too much. So we don't want, you know, this concept of compensation does exist. It does exist. There are bad matchups, I suppose you could say. Not all sets of matchups are good. There aren't perfect ones, but there are some bad ones as well. Different example this time. Say we take center face contact. Imagine a player who, as they swing back, they fall forwards towards the ball. Right. So in most cases, they've just moved towards the ball. So in most cases, they're going to shank it. Right. They're going to present more the heel. And then through impact, they pull their hands in really close to their legs. That might work in terms of matchups. It might be functional. But I would say that is a compensation. Why? Because a person who's falling forwards is going to lose balance. And balance is one of those key things in a golf swing that relates to consistency. And it's one of the things that all professionals has. And you can also, you know, relate it to function as well. It's not just one of those things that all pros have, like they all have a sponsored hat, you know, that doesn't mean they play well, but all having balance does mean you play better. It's a functional thing. So in that regard, I would say the hands getting closer to the body is a compensation for the body moving forwards. I would want to unravel that set of compensations.
Yeah, I see so many players who, you know, you talk about what the pros look like versus the average Joe. You often don't see these extreme looking weight shifts amongst pro golfers. They're like fairly centered over the ball. Whereas if you look at the typical recreational golfer, you'll see them like falling backwards. So their weight gets so far over to their trail side. And then I guess to compensate for that, they like kind of lunge their bodies forward at impact. And then the hands and everything are doing all these crazy things. They're standing up on it sometimes. To me, as someone who's viewed a lot of golf swings, that would be a negative compensation for an extreme weight shift. That's just something I've noticed. And like when I watch a really good ball striker, they're more centered over the ball and kind of coiling more, I think would be a better way to describe their swing around the ball versus falling backward.
Yeah. So another example of that, maybe someone, you know, shifts a lot in their backswing. So they shift a lot to the right, and maybe they even move their head up, and then they have to now compensate by moving down and forwards to get back into position. And I don't like players moving down through impact. If anything, I like a player to rise through impact more. Geometrical reasons why that can be better, as I outline that in the strike plan and NLG as well. Or another example, a player has a really open face throughout the backswing, and then they use a very early release to try and close the face. Again, it can work, it can function, but I don't like that set of matchups because it's not powerful, it leads to ground contact issues. So in terms of compensation, there are things in the swing that I don't like to see, but not everything in the golf swing that veers from textbook is a compensation, is a bad thing necessarily. So that's how I would kind of wrap that thing up. So yeah, do you want to, should we wrap up and end up this long podcast?
Yeah, I think, you know, when I'm thinking back to what we're talking about is that there's so many options to choose from in the golf swing, and nothing is inherently bad and nothing is inherently good. It's how it works together. So we talked about some short-term solutions that actually could be hugely beneficial to someone's game long-term. But we also talked about short-term, quote-unquote, band-aids that are not fixing the root cause. And then no different with compensations where, you know, you look at a lot of pro golfers and they all swing it differently. And they're not, you know, someone would say, oh, it's deviating from the model swing, it's a compensation for that. So it's like, no, they're a great ball striker that figured out to do it this way. It's not textbook, but it works for them because it's producing a functional matchup. And then the bad side of that is like the more extreme examples where the golfer is falling too far on their trail side and then they're falling forward, like they're making all these compensations in their swing that are just not producing good ball flights. So those are not working for them.
There are matchups that hurt performance, like what you're talking about, staying on the backside, swinging left, things like that. There are matchups that hurt performance, and there are matchups that don't hurt performance, like Matt Wolf's takeaway. It doesn't hurt his performance.
For golfers that are going at it alone, they have to pay really close attention to ball flight, seeing what's happening over time. It's a tough task, which is why, like, we don't tell people like to necessarily work on technical stuff if they don't know what they're doing. We'd rather you work on the skill-based stuff, like you mentioned with the slicer, learning how to present the club face at different angles, left, down the line, to the right at impact, just for fun. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to bring it on the course, or shifting your swing path. You know how to swing it to the left. That's why you're slicing. Can you go in the opposite direction and see what that feels like? Those are more meaningful things to build in your arsenal, because that's the adjustments and the skills that are required to get that ball flight back into a better territory. It's a bit of a reoccurring theme on this show, but I thought it was interesting to talk about these things because there's two sides to the coin on everything. Like, nothing is inherently bad. Nothing is inherently good. It's how it relates to you. Your snowflake of a golf swing, so to speak.
Exactly, yeah. All right, let's wrap this one up then. So I'd say summary, quick fixes. Yes, they work fast. They're not all necessarily bad. Don't use the term quick fix as a negative thing. As we talked about, skill development can be quick and both the longest lasting thing. Band-aids, they're usually conscious things. So someone is consciously adding, it's an intentional thing. Might work, but it doesn't deal with the underlying issue. Again, not everything is a band-aid. Things that are deemed band-aids, they're not always, but they do exist. Things that make your outcome better, but doesn't deal with an underlying issue, like, you know, changing the club to deal with a poor angle of attack. A compensation, again, you have to question the idea of model swing being man-made. What is acceptable versus what is just a man-made concept? And if something veers from that, it's deemed as a compensation. It's not necessarily. However, compensations do exist. They're things that, in my terms, they are sets of matchups that reduce efficiency or sets of poor matchups that are functional but hurt your performance in other areas. See everybody next week. I am at adamyounggolf.com. John, where can people find you?
You can find me at practical-golf.com. And thank you to our show sponsor, the Indoor Golf Shop. You can find them for all your indoor golf needs at their website, which is shopindoorgolf.com. They're the experts when it comes to finding the best indoor golf simulator for your home or business. You can give them a call, talk to their guys. Brian and Wade can help you out. Help you make a decision based on your budget, what size you have in your home theater, basement, media room, garage, whatever you've got, they can help. So thanks for their support, and you can find them at shopindoorgolf.com, and we will see you next time with a new episode.